From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
West Oakland.
Richmond, California.
I live in Oakland, California. How you doing?
Coming up on a special hour-long edition of Cross Currents, we'll be joined by radio renaissance man Al Letson. We'll hear a piece from his podcast, Reveal, about a doctor who solved a medical mystery in a Mountain View factory.
Always sworn to secrecy. You don't ever want to let anyone know that I gave this to you.
Then we'll head over to Oakland to see how a 30-year-old game is getting kids off their smartphones.
The kids were eager acquirers of knowledge.
And we'll hear from Al's new podcast, Earthang, about when, as a kid, he got a new older brother.
He had adopted this crazy pit bull of a kid.
The many sides of public radio star Al Letson, today on Cross Currents. Today we're here with Al Letson, host of Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and the podcast Earthang. Al, hi, and is that right? Did I just say it right?
Yeah, you got Reveal right.
Oh, no. How about Earthang?
There you go. You just got to go with it. You just got to Earthang. You got to pretend that you are in the South, you're drinking sweet tea, and it's hot as all outdoors.
Oh, can I drink lemonade?
I'll give you a pass, sure.
Okay, Earthang. So,
Earthang.
Yes. So let's go back to how you got here. Talk about the public radio talent quest and why you even thought of entering.
Sure. So many, many moons ago, I looked online. I was actually Googling American Idol. I wanted to see who had won the contest. And the first thing that popped up was NPR's American Idol. I thought that it was going to be a folk singing competition, but it turned out, and listen, I like folk singing, so whatever. So I clicked on it, and it turned out to be a contest to find new hosts, new shows, new ideas. I had been traveling the country as a flight attendant, and I felt that the story that was being told about America wasn't the complete story. And I'd always thought of this idea of, like, you know, being able to tell that story. And so when I saw this opportunity, I applied for it. Me and another Bay Area resident, my man, Mr. Glenn Washington, of Snap Judgment, we ended up winning the contest together. So he made Snap Judgment and I went on to make State of the Reunion. And State of the Reunion, we closed up shop. We've won 3 Murrow Awards back to back. And we won a Peabody last year. So the show did really well. It was just expensive to make. And then around the time when So True was closing up, the other show that I had been hosting, Reveal, started moving into regular production. And so, yeah, so now I am out in the Bay doing Reveal with the Center for Investigative Reporting. And there is an amazing group of people over there. We're having a really good time, and we'll be going weekly in January. So I'm excited about that.
Awesome. Had you grown up on, you know, storytelling and stories, and like, where did this come from?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, since I was a kid, I love to tell stories. I love to act and, you know, do all sorts of stuff like that. I think the older I got, the more it kind of refined into, you know, storytelling. When I was younger, I was like doing hip hop, and like the type of hip hop I was doing was mostly like storytelling. And then I started writing poetry, and those poems were mostly monologues, and then monologues turned into theater, and then all of that kind of culminated in me doing, you know, the whole storytelling thing. So yeah, I mean, I do a lot of different things, but I think all of them kind of fall under the umbrella of being a storyteller.
We are in our fall membership campaign, Al, and this is a great time for people to really support this station, support this show that is bringing you on, Al Letson, one of the favorites of not only the Bay Area, of course, because your shows have come out of here, but really the public radio world. And this is a great time to support all of that. Give us a call at 800-525-9917 to make a contribution to our fall membership campaign. Or you can go to kalw.org and make a contribution there, supporting KALW, supporting local public radio. That brings you Al Letson. Al Letson is with me right now. So We want to get into your first story, Al, and I'm wondering if you could introduce it for us.
Sure. All those electronic gadgets from phones to flat screens have been made somewhere. Recently, conditions at electronics factories, like the ones in China that make Apple devices, have come under scrutiny. But Silicon Valley used to have its own local electronics factories. Today, Mountain View is known for the offices of Google, but 35 years ago, it was the site of a medical mystery. Workers were using dangerous chemicals without being told what they were or how to properly protect themselves, reveals Laura Starcheski reports.
Yvette Flores was 18 when she got her first job, back in 1975. She worked in a factory in Mountain View, California, for a company called Spectra Physics. She made barcode scanners for supermarket checkout lines.
So, you know, when you go into a grocery store and you hear that beep, that's what I made.
At that time, those scanners were a very new thing. Yvette hadn't even seen one in a store herself. And when she got to work, she would go into a tiny room with almost no ventilation. She'd put on a white smock and a paper mask, and then she'd mix these liquid chemicals in a beaker with a gritty powder.
It was very powdery, and it looked green. I would call it green junk.
She'd heat that liquid with a blowtorch and use the mixture to fuse two pieces of glass together. That was her job. The fumes were strong.
It got so hot in there, I would have to go into the other room. That wasn't any better, but it was more circulation there to breathe.
Years went by as Yvette worked in that little room. She got married. In 1979, she had her son, Mark.
When Mark was born, he just had medical problems.
For one thing, his head was covered in bright red marks called hematomas.
It was like blood blisters on his head. And his eyes were crossed, and his hips were dislocated.
No one explained anything to Yvette about the cause of Mark's problems, and she didn't ask.
It didn't dawn on me, you know. I just went, that's my son. You know, when can I take him home?
About two-thirds of the workers in those early electronics factories were young women like Yvette. And if they got hurt on the job, occupational medicine specialist Dr. Joe Ledoux was the guy some of them saw. Ledoux didn't know a lot about what these new companies were making or how they were making it, but he soon learned that many workers used hydrofluoric acid to etch lines into computer chips.
I saw hundreds and hundreds of hydrofluoric acid splashes on people.
And when this acid gets on your skin, it can go straight through down to the bone. Some of the burns were so bad, workers were losing parts of their bodies.
Fingers and toes, noses. It was just horrific.
Patients would stumble into his clinic barely awake.
They were in first stage anesthesia.
From inhaling the solvents they used on the job. Ledoux would ask his patients, what did you breathe in? Very few could tell him. So we tried asking the companies.
I got nowhere doing that for years.
But he was sometimes the guy the companies called when there was an accident.
When the companies would evacuate an entire building because of fumes exposure, they would call me over to say something to address the issue. And I would say, well, what were the workers exposed to? And everyone would just shrug. It was like, your job is to tell everyone they're okay and let us get back to manufacturing.
So Ledoux got creative. He developed sources inside the companies and state agencies, people he could get information from.
Always sworn to secrecy, always dealing with, you don't ever want to let anyone know that I gave this to you.
Ledoux got his hands on enough data to find that workers in the semiconductor factories where chips were made had occupational illnesses at four times the rate of other industries. And it wasn't just workers feeling the effects, but their kids too.
Miscarriages, congenital malformations, or birth defects in the children.
Sending ripple effects decades into the future, into the lives of those families today.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to my Marcos.
That's Yvette Flores with her son Mark at their home in San Jose.
That was good. You did really good, Mia.
Yvette's the woman who worked in the barcode scanner factory, heating up that green powder with a blowtorch.
You're tired?
Yeah.
Okay, you want to get your pajamas on?
Yeah.
All right.
Mark's 35, but his brain works a lot like the brain of a 2 or 3 year old.
You gotta hang your shirt up.
Hang your shirt up?
Can you do that?
I need help.
You need help?
Yeah.
I love your
Yvette's
help.
Been taking care of Mark since he was born. She never connected his problems to her job at Spectrophysics until one day about 6 years ago when she was driving in her car and she turned on the radio and heard this.
Birth defects have been linked to toxic chemicals and solvents used in semiconductor and computer chip clean rooms. If your child was born with skeletal, organ, or limb deformities...
Yvette called the number in the ad. She started working with a lawyer who eventually figured out that that green powder she'd been working with was ground leaded glass. It turned out that in that tiny room, Yvette had been breathing lead fumes for 5 years. The company had never warned her.
They had to see me pregnant. They knew. And I wish they would have just pulled me out of there and just said, you can't work there no more. If I would have known, you know what, I would have ran so fast. There's no excuse.
Yvette won a settlement from Spectrophysics in 2013. The company didn't return my calls, but in a court filing, they maintained that it hadn't been proven that Mark's condition was caused by chemical exposure in their factory.
That was Reveal's Laura Starczewski. And at this point, you might be thinking a company like Spectrophysics could never get away with exposing workers to such dangerous chemicals today, right? Well, Jim Morris from the Center for Public Integrity is going to help us tackle that one. Jim works on worker safety, and he brought us Mark and Yvette's story. Jim says when it comes to chemical exposure, factory workers are actually less protected than the rest of us.
Cancer risks from chemical exposures that would never be tolerated outside the plant fence are not only tolerated, but legal inside the plant.
This is for a couple reasons. First, OSHA, the federal agency charged with protecting worker safety, sets legal limits for how much of a chemical is safe to breathe. But most of those limits are based on science from the 1950s and 60s. Even OSHA has admitted they don't do enough to protect workers from dangerous chemicals.
Chemicals that can cause cancer, chemicals that have reproductive effects, can cause heart disease, severe respiratory disease, and it's all perfectly legal.
And when companies do break the rules, even in the most extreme ways, the federal workplace safety law doesn't do much to punish them.
Right now, if you commit an egregious act that results in a worker's death, that's a misdemeanor. The most you can get is 6 months in jail. If you kill an endangered species, you can go to jail for a year. So it quite literally is true that you can get in more trouble for killing wildlife than you can for killing a worker.
That was the voice of Jim Morris from the story Toxic Tech in America from Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can hear Reveal on KLW at 11 a.m. on the second Friday of each month. And with me is Al Letson, the host of Reveal. Hey, Al.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hey, so that story was reported by Laura Starczewski, one of your partners from the days of So True. So she went to work with NPR and now to CIR. Can you tell us a story about some of your work with her? What's she like? I know she just got married. Congratulations.
Yes. Laura's amazing. You know, when I came over to the Center for Investigative Reporting and we started really thinking about staffing and what we were going to do as far as hiring producers, the people that I work with at State of the Reunion, they were obviously at the top of my list because, you know, we were such a small show with a really small staff. We became super tight, but it also meant that everybody had to work really hard. And Laura has just got this engine about her. I mean, like, she just goes. And, you know, once she gets hold of a story, she just doesn't let it go. So she and I have been all over the country and some of the strangest places and had some really crazy experiences. So, you know, she's like a family member. We're really tight, but she is an amazing producer and really thorough with the work that she does. So I was really happy when she left NPR and came over to the Center for Investigative Reporting.
All right. And the Center for Investigative Reporting, where you work here in Emeryville, you know, just across the bridge from where we are here at KALW. Give us a glimpse of behind the scenes at CIR. You just imagine it to be this really cool, slick place with all these reporters that look like they're sleuthing around looking for clues.
It actually is exactly. I mean, the building itself is pretty awesome. And it's filled with all these reporters who are like hardcore. They've got this whole data team. And the funny thing, though, is that it's a really light environment. Like everybody, we report these really heavy stories, but everybody there is just really cool and down to have a good time. And it's probably because, you know, the leader of CIR is a couple different people, but one that comes to mind would be Joaquin Alvarado. And he's sort of like a mad scientist genius. He's always cooking up some kind of plan. I actually do a pretty good impersonation of him.
Well, we'd like to hear but, it, please.
No, I can't do it. I'll get fired. he's great, but I don't want to lose my job. the whole senior staff there at CIR, they're pretty amazing people. And so we do really hard work. But I feel like the motto there is, you know, respect the work and take the work seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously. So we all have a really good time, but we put in the hours to make a great show.
Mm-hmm. Well, here at KALW, we also like to work hard to make good shows and bring people like you to our air. And the audience can support that today. We are in our fall membership campaign. We would love it if you would call right now to make a contribution during this campaign towards KALW. 800-525-9917 is the number to call, or go to kalw.org and make a contribution there, make a donation there, and pick from one of the many, many gifts we have there. But I think this one might interest people who are Al Letson fans and Reveal fans and just podcast fans in general. We have a gift. If you pledge at the $120 level, we will send you this book by Jessica Abel called Out on the Wire, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio. We have a master of radio right now on the line with us in Al Letson. But in this book, you can also hear, you can read stories from Radio Labs, Jada Bumrad, Planet Money's Robert Smith. Who else is in this book?
Glenn Ira Washington.
Glenn
Washington from Snap Judgment.
Ira Glass, all of these people, you can hear from them in this book at the $120 level. And if you want to bump it up just a little bit to the $240 level, we will send you the book and two tickets to go see Glenn Washington and Roman Mars, some of the, you know, foremost radio stars right now, live at an event at the JCCSF in San Francisco on Monday, September 21st. And so this is a great value. $240, you get the book and two tickets to go to this event, but only if you call right now at 800-525-9917 or go to kalw.org. Al Letson, you know, public radio has carried, is, you know, our station here, KALW especially, has been the first one to carry these new podcasts, to be an incubator for podcasting, and shows like, you know, 99% Invisible. We were the first in the Bay Area to air Snap Judgment. What do you think the value
is? You also was the first in the Bay Area to air State of the Reunion.
Hey, yes, you noticed.
I noticed. Well, why do you think I'm here? you love me, I love you back.
Hey, we love us some Al Letson. So why should people give then to public radio? What is the importance of that?
I think, you know, the importance of giving to public radio is this, is that you can cut on the television, you can go on the internet, you can go all sorts of places to get your news from different places to gather your storytelling. But what public radio has is a certain level of trust. We have people from all walks of life that come in to tell you their story that you're not going to hear anywhere else. You're not going to hear it on Fox. You're not going to hear it even on MSNBC, because we don't have all these people arguing with each other over the facts and details. What we bring you are, you know, unbiased reports, but also people telling their authentic story of themselves and where they are. And a station like KALW is like right in the heart of the community. I love KALW because it is so funky. Like, by far, it is the funkiest public radio station I've ever been to. Now, that's not talking bad about other radio stations. I'm just saying that KALW got the funk. And therefore, you should support the funk, because we all need a little funk in our life.
Because we've got the funk. Oh, they have to play that song under here.
There you go. They have to play it.
800-525-9917. Give us a call right now. Support public radio, local public radio that brings you Al Letson, the first to bring you State of the Reunion. And you can get these tickets to see the Masters of Public Radio live at the JCCSF. $240 contribution gets you two tickets to see Roman Mars, Glenn Washington, Jessica Abel, all, and the book Out on the Wire by Jessica Abel, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio. Give us a call at 800-525-9917. We need 20 calls or clicks during this hour. We are challenged. You are challenged. We need to hear from you. 800-525-9917. All right. So, Al, I'd like to talk about another one of your passions, besides public radio, comic books. Tell me about your love for comic books.
I love comic books. I'm actually dyslexic, and the way that I learned how to get past the dyslexia was through comic books. So for me, like, they just hold such a big place in my heart. I love them, love them, love them. Literally, if I could make a bed of comic books, I would, so I can just roll over and read a story. I love them.
Do you have a favorite that you can say?
Yeah, I totally have a favorite. So, like, you know, my comic book taste kind of goes in various different directions. So, like, if you're talking superhero stuff, you know, Spider-Man is always going to be my guy. Spider-Man and the Green Lantern, although lately the Green Lantern is a little off. And if we're talking about, you know, sort of like sci-fi type stuff, my favorite comic right now would be Saga by Brian K. Vaughan, which is, like, amazing. And then, you know, I also like some more realistic stuff. I think one of my favorite graphic novels would be American Born Chinese. So it just, you know, it goes across the gamut from superheroes to everyday Joes.
Well, then you will be happy to know that our next story takes place in a comic book shop in Oakland. First, a little backstory. A much-discussed announcement from the American Academy of Pediatrics suggested that 8 to 10-year-olds spend 8 hours a day with screens. That's TV and mobile devices. This has some parents worried that their kids aren't learning how to play well with others, other people. In Oakland, there's an after-school program trying to combat the problem of too much screen time. It's almost 30 years old, but the challenges it's facing are very new. KALW reporter Rafi Ronquillo visited and brings us this story.
Eli McAmis is 14 years old. He and five other young teens sit around a table, each rolling dice and flipping through game manuals, peering over thick binders, each with hundreds of pages of information.
The character I'm playing this week, it's a Fishan. They're a race of sort of cat-like people. His name's Chevrolet Uno.
They're on a mission. A long-form story where participants act out exactly what their characters are doing in real time. These missions take place in the invented world of Abante, where magic is real, cooperation is key, and a player's decisions can have lasting consequences.
Like, if you go in and try and negotiate a solution through a non-violent approach, you get reward for that. But if you go in guns blazing and kill everyone in the room, that's not as good. It's kind of an awful thing to do, really.
Line up, John.
And a credit.
This is the Roleplay Workshop, an after-school program that's been around since 1989. Tucked away on the second story of an Oakland comic book shop, teens are getting together to do everything from combating Tyrannosaurus Rexes to negotiating with various guild leaders.
When we first started, the kids were eager acquirers of knowledge. They would try to figure out how to make characters, to write things down, to just do it themselves.
Becky Thomas is the program's founder and its current director. You can find her here most days supervising the games. She says the kids are always excited to be here, but recently she's noticed them having a harder time completing tasks on their own. It's become necessary to explain even simple things, like opening and reading the game manual.
They need more and more outside assistance. They don't open the book unless you tell them to. They don't. They'll stare blankly at a page and not extract information until you tell them what sentence to read.
She says that over the last 5 to 10 years, the kids in her program have increasingly had trouble solving problems in a group. She thinks that the streamlined reward systems, commonly used by many apps and video games, have hurt their ability to effectively work together.
I don't think that the screen interface is quite as permanent for learning. I think it's a great tool. But I think that most of our root learning, our core learning, has to start much more immediate, much more real.
This is a pretty new area of study, but there's some research that suggests she's right. For example, a 2014 UCLA study found that kids got better at reading other people's emotions when they spent time away from screens.
Let's go. Steve, where's the adventurer standard rate stuff?
Back of the book. Probably like 118.
So what started as a game created simply for fun has evolved into a platform that's helping kids build basic skills. Skills like picking up on various social cues.
We take on all of those roles. In some senses, it is very much that we act each and every person that those characters interact with, what those kids interact with.
What Thomas is invoking in part is what some psychologists refer to as social learning theory, which boils down to the idea that we learn in social contexts by observing and interacting with others.
So if I'm a good game master and I'm a good role player, then when a player's character interacts with a sad person, mm-hmm. I am doing all the facial expressions and all the intonations of a sad person.
I would go into role play where whatever we do and whatever we say, our character does and says.
That's Jared Dale. He's 13 and has been playing Abante for about a year. One of the harder parts of the game, Dale says, is actually the role-playing itself.
It's very intense because if you say something wrong or out of character that could jeopardize a mission, you'll lose points for role-play that we get at the end of the week.
Actually, instead of putting them on Sapphire, I'll use the Sapphire to move them over, sling them over my horse's back.
Sitting here at the game table, the players are each constantly going over their in-game actions so as to not overlook anything that might harm their chances of success. Today, Dale is taking the lead at the table.
I've kind of learned a little bit of leadership. I'm trying to become a staff member here at Abante. And this week, being one of the most experienced players, I've learned how to kind of direct the younger, less experienced players.
Becky Thomas says she sees kids like Dale develop more confidence.
And to me, that's actually the power of a role-playing game, is that you're getting to do things you could never do in real life with a person who is bigger, taller, stronger, faster, whatever. And you get to be a hero, right? You get to figure it out. You get to save the day.
Should we go to the Healer's Guild now?
As I look around the room, kids here are immersed in their books. They're eagerly talking with each other and making jokes. But most importantly, they're getting to be kids.
That's 60 gold an hour.
In Oakland, I'm Rafi Ronquillo for Cross Currents.
Okay, 60 gold an hour.
Or less. No, we're doing a daily roll.
If you know a kid or an adult even who wants to visit the world of Abante, you can learn more at kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba, here with the master, the radio jack of all trades, Mr. Al Letson. Hey, Al.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hi. So have you ever played role play games? Are you into that?
I did a little when I was younger, but the older I get, the less desire I have to do it.
What was it like when you were younger? What games did you play?
When I was younger, I mean, I'm kind of dating myself, but it was all about Dungeons and Dragons. But yeah, like I only played it every now and then. I was much more of a comic book nerd than I was a role player.
Mm. And how about now? Are you a gamer at all? Or are you not into
I'm
that?
Not because I don't have any time. I literally I had this one game that I played all the time, and I had to take it off my computer because it was so addictive and I wasn't getting any work done. So no, I'm not a gamer. I have an addictive personality. Like whatever I do, I've got to do to the fullest extent and I can't let it go. And I'm too competitive. Oh my goodness. I'm way too competitive.
Oh no. And you know, that story was about screen time. You know, do you get a lot of screen time? Do you feel like it's too much? How do you relax?
That's a good question. I don't know how to relax. Time. I don't, you know, like I love the outdoors, although I don't like the idea of sleeping outdoors. Like, I don't get that. I'm sorry.
Like, no camping.
No camping at all. No, thank you. But I do love like hiking and going out for day trips. So yeah, like that's kind of how I get away, I think.
Awesome. Well, we just heard a story from inside a comic book store, and you are a lover of comic books. So as part of our fall membership campaign that's going right now at KALW, one of the awesome gifts that people can get if they call right now at 800-525-9917 is the book Out on the Wire, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio by Jessica Abel. And it's a graphic novel. She's a cartoonist. She tells these stories about Ira Glass, about Planet Money's Robert Smith, Jada Boomrod, Roman Mars. She draws them all and tells these stories through cartooning. So very cool. You can have it right now for a $120 contribution if you give us a call at 800-525-9917 or go to KALW.org, make a contribution of $120 and get your comic book, essentially. A graphic novel. Is a graphic novel a comic book, Al Letson?
Yeah, they can be. They totally can be. I mean, so like a graphic novel can be a book that's created to just be, you know, a graphic novel, or it can be a collection of single issue comic books that have been collected into a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, like a graphic novel is like a bigger story. And this graphic novel sounds pretty amazing. I haven't read it yet, but listen, if you, the listener, would like to pledge the, what is it, $120?
$120.
If you will pledge the $120, get that book, you can gift it to me. So it all works out. Everybody's happy.
All right. Where can they call?
800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can donate online at KALW.org.
And you can get this book at the $120 level. But if you want to pay more and go and support KALW more on a higher level, $240, we'll send you that graphic narrative book. And we'll also send you two tickets to go to the JCCSF and see Roman Mars, Glenn Washington live and meet them as well at a special reception, which sounds really enticing. That's at the $240 level. Call now at 800-525-9917. Our phone volunteers are waiting for your call. When you call, say which gift you want so they know. And tell us why you're listening to public radio, why you're listening to KALW, why you listen to Cross Currents. We really love to hear from our listeners. And when we get those emails and when we connect with you on Facebook, we feel like you're part of us, we're part of you, and we're making this together. So give us a call and be part of that at 800-525-9917. And we still need the 20 calls or clicks. I think we're making some progress, but we need some more. And you are there to help us reach that goal. And these are the final days of the drive. And so we are pushing towards this goal so we can end on time. But we can only do that with your support at 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Al Letson, what are some of the podcasts and the shows that you like to hear on public radio?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a huge fan of 99% Invisible. You know, I love all the big shows like Radiolab. Obviously, I'm a Serial fan. Adnan, I think, probably is guilty, but shouldn't have been convicted.
Ooh, we're not going to get into that.
We're not going to get into that. I mean, I'm just saying that there like was not enough evidence, even though I think that he had something to do with it. Like, reasonable doubt, there was reasonable doubt. I digress. Yeah, I like one of my favorite podcasts is produced by another member of the So True family, and that's Tina Antolini. She's working on a podcast called Gravy, which it's just all gravy. It's
awesome.
Beautiful. It's about food in the South and how people connect through food. So it's a really great podcast.
Great.
You know, I love listening to anything the Kitchen Sisters do. You know, my tastes are kind of all over the place.
All right. That's Al Letson. And you, your new project that you've been working on, your new show, Earthing.
I think I got it.
Thank you for your help. Why don't you set up the Earthing episode that we're going to listen to next about growing up with a sibling?
Yes. So the first episode of Earthing, we decided to have a little bit of fun and sort of do an origin story. The question is, like, how did Al Letson become as screwed up as he is now? So we decided to tell a story that goes way back to my childhood. And this is the story of gaining an older sibling.
All right. Let's hear it.
So our first story here on Earthang is called Big Brother Almighty. But to tell this story, I have to go back, way back. You see, today, everybody calls me Al, but when I was a kid, everyone called me Alfie.
What's it all about, Alfie?
A friend of mine tried to give me this CD recently, and I wanted to strangle him.
Alfie.
I have heard that song so many times. Anyway, from 0 to 7, I was an only child. I was a little lonely. I had this crazy imagination. Crazy. I was the original Calvin and Hobbes. I would build these imaginary worlds and play in them all day long. But I had a longing, a deep desire in my little adolescent heart. I wanted a sibling. I grew up watching my three sons, Family Affair, Good Times, and they all had siblings. Yeah, they fought occasionally, but they had fun, lots of fun, and I wanted a sibling more than anything. Now, I didn't understand how all that works. I mean, I was 6 or 7 years old, no clue. But I knew if it was going to happen, my parents had to help that process. So I lobbied them hard. And let me tell you, at that age, I could be the cutest kid in the world, or I could be the most irritating child in the world.
Please, 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 please.
Anyway, my lobbying paid off because one day my parents told me they were going to adopt. This was a wondrous thing. This was great. I mean, I got a ready-made kid. No baby stuff, straight to playing with toys and having fun. Yes! I don't remember the process of picking kids. I vaguely recall meeting 1 or 2 other kids, and they were younger than me and didn't seem all that fun. And then I met Lawan. Lawan was 3 years older than me, and at 10 years old, he was cool. So cool that instantly I wanted to be like him. First we hung out for a day, then a weekend, then a couple months, and those were the best days. I had just gotten this new bike, so I let him ride that, and I rode my old one, and we would just cruise around the neighborhood and have a good time. And when the process was done, Lawan was officially my brother. I went everywhere in the neighborhood and introduced him as my new brother, and all the kids in the neighborhood thought he was cool. I mean, he was from the hood, and we lived in the suburbs. He was tough. He cursed. He knew how to talk to the ladies. He was like the Fonz.
Hey!
All the kids loved him. All the kids except Gerard. Now, Gerard was a neighborhood bully. He lived in a cul-de-sac, and every house in the circle was members of his family. Most of the neighborhood kids didn't go down there because Gerard was king, and he had an army to back him up. At 16, Gerard towered over all of us kids, and we were scared to death. Now, Gerard never touched me. He would just always pick on me, call me names, laugh at my little bike because it was light blue, and he had all his cousins chase me around, and it was no fun, so I definitely stayed away. But now, I had a big brother. So I went down there to show my brother off, and when Gerard saw Lawan, it was like two pit bulls circling each other. There was tension in the air. Now, Lawan at this age is like 10 years old. Gerard is 16, so he was way bigger than Lawan. But my brother does not know what backing down means. As custom, Gerard started picking on me, and my brother would not stand for it. He started calling Gerard names and talking about his mother, pushing all of the buttons that I didn't even know existed. It was amazing. Finally, the big bully is getting his due. Yes, I have a big brother. Then Gerard, the 16-year-old, punched my brother, the 10-year-old, in the face.
Oh, snap!
Yow! Luan fell on the ground and bounced back up, ready to fight, and Gerard was ready too, but the rest of Gerard's family pulled him away. They didn't want him fighting someone so young and told us to get out of there. Eventually, Luan and I got on our bikes and rode home. But before we did, Luan looked Gerard in the eyes and said, "I'm gonna get you back." I was gonna tell my parents, but Luan told me not to, so I just did what he told me to and shut up. That night I tried to comfort him and tell him what a jerk Gerard was, but Luan was too mad to hear it. He told me to shut up. And then he said the only reason why he stayed with my family, why he decided to go along with the adoption, is because he wanted my bike. And then he proceeded to beat me up. Nothing major in the master's degree I've earned in beatdown victimization. This was merely just the introductory course. It gets harder from here. It struck me that we had just adopted a pit bull. I mean, I thought about telling my parents, but then either they'd send him back or I'd just get beat up again, and I didn't want either one of those, so I just shut up. The next 3 years, Luan and I got to know each other better. He established himself as the alpha male, and I was more than happy to play the background. When he was in a bad mood, he could be brutal. But most of the time, he was all right, as long as he had my bike, which I never got back. Then one day, my parents tell us that they are having a baby. What? A baby? A baby? Now, I'm 10. And in a matter of 3 years, I went from being the only child to a middle child. Who does that happen to? Me, obviously. And with my folks having a baby, we were moving into a bigger house. So for weeks, we packed up the house, and on the last day, my parents let Luan and I go play one last time in the neighborhood and say goodbye to everyone. And when we got in the backyard to grab our bikes, Luan turned to me and said, "Listen, I want you to go down to the cul-de-sac. I want you to start a fight with Gerard and just wait." A fight with Gerard? Are you crazy? Are you crazy? Now, Gerard is 19 years old. I'm 10, and my brother is telling me to go start a fight with him. Now, in the 3 years we've been living in this house together, we never really went down to Gerard's cul-de-sac. I mean, every now and then, but on a whole, we stayed away from it. And now my brother is telling me to go down there and start a fight? I told him, "No, not doing it." And my brother grabbed me by the shirt, looked at me and said, "If you don't go down there and start a fight with Gerard, I'm going to start a fight with you." When my brother made a threat, he always followed through. Make no mistake, if he told me that he was going to get me that night, oh, he got me. And therefore, looking at him and thinking about the damage that he could do to me for the rest of my life and the short damage that Gerard might do to me while I was in the cul-de-sac is a no-brainer. I was going to the cul-de-sac. Immediately after that, Luan got on his bike and rode away. I have no idea where he went at the time. I got on my bike and slowly rode down to the cul-de-sac. Now, I gotta tell you, like, that's a, like, 2-minute ride, but it must have taken me at least 10 to 15 minutes to get down there. And when I got there, all Gerard's cousins, the kids, were out in the cul-de-sac, and they saw me coming, and they started teasing me about my little blue bike. Now, beyond the cul-de-sac was a park that all of us used to go play basketball or tennis or just run around and play football. What I didn't know at the time is my brother had rode his bike all the way from our house into the park. He then climbed up a steep hill and got into the backyard of one of the houses in the cul-de-sac where he could see everything that was going on. So I'm there and Gerard's cousins are teasing me and I'm not paying them any mind. And I walk up to Gerard and I start talking about his mama.
Your mama's so stupid. Your mama wearing combat boots. Your mama's so dumb. Your mama's so old. Her memory's in black and white.
And Gerard got angry and he started to move in on me and everybody was like, ooh,
snap. Gerard, you gonna let him talk to you like that?
Everybody started to move away as Gerard started to move in closer. And just as Gerard's shadow hit me, I saw my brother's hand tap him from behind. And when Gerard turned around, Lawan had a brick in his hand and he bashed it up against his head. Gerard fell to the ground with a cry and everyone else backed up, screaming.
No! Son, you see that?
Lawan stood over Gerard as he rolled on the ground, blood seeping out of a cut on his head. He looked down at the older boy and kicked him really hard in the stomach and said, I told you I'd get you back. Don't mess with the Letson boys. He then grabbed my bike, told me to get on the handlebars, and we rode as fast as we could back to our house. Now, when we got back to the house, my parents had already packed everything up, and it was time to leave. They put my bike in the back of the truck. My brother told them that he left his in the park, so they drove around, picked it up, and then we went to our new house and unpacked. That night, in our new bedroom, everything was different. The sounds, the smells, everything was strange. We got in our bunk beds to go to sleep, and Lawan leaned down from the top bunk and said, no one is ever going to pick on you or beat you up again. Now, in retrospect, he probably should have said, no one is ever going to pick on you or beat you up again except me. But I digress. At that moment, it felt like a revelation. Yeah, we had adopted this crazy pit bull of a kid, but he was my pit bull. He was my brother.
That was Al Letson talking about his big brother in the first episode of his new podcast, Thing. Al Letson is the host of Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and is the creator and host of State of the Reunion and now Thing. Hey, Al.
Hey, hey, we're just doing a little bit of Thing on KALW. These are the last days. So everybody, you've got to call in 1-800-525-9917. The last days of the pledge. Please hook it up.
Hook it up at KALW.org and make that contribution right now. Al Letson is asking you to support public radio at 800-525-9917. Al, we just heard that great story. How's your relationship today with Big Brother Lawan?
It's interesting.
Okay.
No, it's good. It's good. Yeah.
All right, it's we'll good. Move on. Did you ever hear from Gerard again?
No. You know, it's funny because I was recently in New York and I went to my hometown, New Jersey, and I was driving down those streets and I was wondering if Gerard still lived around there. By this time, you know, he's probably in his 50s.
Did your stomach hurt when you were driving over there in that area? Did you get the butterflies?
Yeah, a little bit. Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that going back into that neighborhood after not being, you know, having gone there in like over 20 years, the neighborhood seems so much smaller than it did. Like, it seems like the streets in my mind were huge and the houses were huge. And now going back, like, no, they're actually, it's really just a normal little neighborhood. You know, like, not a big deal. And Gerard probably was not as big as what I thought he was in my mind. You know, he's probably a midget in my head, like he was huge, you know.
Oh, well, that was a great.
So, no, I did not see him. I've never seen him again, thankfully. And my brother and I have figured out a nice little truce.
All right, there you go. Well, that's such a good story to hear. And I want to ask you about Thing. There's been a lot of conversation about the sound of public radio, and particularly There's a conversation on black reporters and black hosts talking about having to sound white. We've had some reporting on that here at KLW by our amazing reporter, Leela Day. And I was wondering, you know, we're talking about having to sound white, and there's this conversation happening, and here you come with air thing. So,
yes.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, does this have anything to do with the other?
No, I mean, like, so that conversation about having to sound white on air, I think it's an interesting and an important conversation, but it's not one that I've ever really cared about in the sense of, like, I don't care whether somebody thinks I sound too black on the airwaves. Mm-hmm. I could care less. Just cut the radio off if you don't like the way I sound. Like, there are plenty of people that I listen to on the radio and I don't like the sound of their voice, so I just cut it off. I really don't care. I think that, like, I have always been trying to find my authentic self and present that on the airwaves, you know, as I can. So I've never really had that conflict. That being said, you know, I grew up in a very middle class house, and I was taught to code switch at a really early age. So, you know, a lot of times I code switch without even thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I'm on the air, I might sound different than I do when I'm out living my everyday life. But it's not something I consciously think or worry about. But I think it's an important conversation for people to have. When it came to Earthang, for me, like, it was, you know, I had all these ideas about what I wanted to do with this show. This show is really like a place for me to blow off steam and have a little bit of fun, because Reveal is a great show, but it can be really heavy, and it's all news and documentary, and it doesn't give me a chance to really stretch my comedic and my storytelling style. And plus, I do a lot of different things. So that's kind of where the show came from. And I had all these pretentious names when I first got started, like, or in my mind, like, I had all these pretentious names. One of them was like the Renaissance Man mixtape. And I'm like, oh, my God, that sounds like so ugh. And I was talking to a friend about it, just saying I couldn't figure out a name. And I said, man, I just want to do Earthang. And then it struck me that, like, yes, that's it. Like, we're just going to call the show Earthang. And it's going to be what it is. And some people are going to love it, and some people are going to hate it. And that is totally okay with me. You know, it wasn't a response to that, but it definitely stands firm in the idea of, like, I'm just going to be me, and people are going to dig it or they're not, and that's okay.
All right. And we just want to be us here at KLW. We are in the final minutes of this hour. This is your chance to help us meet our goal. 800-525-9917. Give us a call as our fall membership campaign. We need to end on time. These are the final minutes of this Cross Currents, and we're in the final days of this drive. We are pushing towards our goal, but we can only do that if you give us your support right now. 800-525-9917. I think, oh, there we go. The people are in the phone room there, and some are on the phone, some are not on the phones. They all need to be on the phone. 800-525-9917. Go to klw.org. Make your contribution. $120 gets you the Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio graphic novel, and $240 gets you the book and two tickets live to see Roman Mars and Glenn Washington. 800-525-9917. With us, it's Al Letson. He likes to talk about everything, right, Al?
Just about.
All right. So he is here to support KALW. You are here. You're listening. So if you've been putting it off, this is the time. This is the time to do it. 800-525-9917. Just a few minutes left.
Come on, where else are you going to get these great stories, podcasts, and news all in one place? Right here at KALW, and we are looking to you. You specifically. Yes, I'm talking to you.
You.
We're looking at you. Pick up your phone, dial in 1-800-525-9917. We need your help. Public radio is all about community. I mean, like, that's the only way that public radio stays on the air. It may be the only thing in America that is specifically about community and needs community support to keep going. We're not built like your traditional capitalist value system, right? Like, you get to decide what you're going to give to us. But we continue to give you great product and programming for your ears, for your brain, and for your soul. So right now, we are asking you to help us to continue to do that. 1-800-525-9917 or kalw.org.
You heard it from Al Lutzen. Thank you very much, Al, for being with us this hour.
It has been my pleasure.
All right. You can still call at 800-525-9917 or kalw.org. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
KALW is just earthing.
This is KALW San Francisco.